how many men over and across America who are speaking about the spiritual life and the matter and the need of being sanctified. But there is none whom I would rather hear and whom I would rather present to you as a speaker along this line than our friend Dr. A.W. Tozer, who is now minister of the Avenue Road Christian and Missionary Alliance Church in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and the editor of the Alliance with us. It has been a real joy to have had him with us for these weekday afternoons. God bless you, Dr. Tozer.
It's been a pleasure to be here. You have to do some things by faith, and preaching here is being done by faith. I don't know what contribution I've made, but I'm trusting that it has been a little bit. Worth my carfare, maybe. Now, I want to talk today, as I promised or threatened yesterday, on the text, "He must increase, but I must decrease." Verse 25 of John 3, there arose a question between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purifying. And they came to John and said to him, "Rabbi, he that was with thee beyond Jordan, to whom thou bearest witness, behold, the same baptizes, and all men come to him." John answered and said, and I like the way John changed the subject here. John answered and said, "A man can receive nothing except it be given him from heaven. Ye yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ. I am sent before him. He that has the bride, the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, which is me, John, which standeth and heareth him, he rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice." Takes a pristine, unselfish bridegroom, or best man, I mean, to stand and rejoice in the good fortune of the bridegroom and not be jealous. "This my joy, therefore, is fulfilled." I think this is one of the most selfless testimonies ever given here. And he added, for the last seven words in English, we have it at least, ever uttered by this man in public. "He must increase, but I must decrease." Now these men, Jesus and John, were baptized. In their journey, they had come near to each other. Although, of course, Jesus himself didn't actually put people down into the water, but his disciples, as it says across the page in John 4. John was bringing his colorful ministry to a close. We know, no matter how spiritual we get, we're still pretty much committed to our humanity. Yet down here, up there, it's going to be different. And when I say that John was a colorful man, I'm using a dirty word, a word that's gotten into baseball, into the theater, into politics, got all kicked around. But you can't get away from it, and there isn't any other word. John was a colorful character. Some people have color and some don't. He used to say about two baseball players, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, they said Babe Ruth could strike out and get more applause than little Lou Gehrig got when he hit a home run. There are colorful men. And then there are men who just preach. I'm the latter type. I don't have any color. I don't even have any in my hair anymore. The man who has color has an awful time getting it separated from the Holy Ghost, so that he knows when it's God and when it's color. But a man who is comfortably without color, he knows it's either God or else he won't get invited back. Now, John had color, and he was bringing his ministry to a close, and Jesus was getting his underway. Each was fulfilling his divine commission. And there was no rivalry except in the minds of the people, somebody said. But nevertheless, jealousy arose among the followers of John and of Jesus. And they came to him, or came to John, to try to get him to settle this problem about baptism. And it appeared to be a sincere question. There was really no question asked. They came and stated the situation. But you know, the theological problem was inspired by causes that were ulterior. When I hear people criticizing each other or somebody that isn't present, I like to probe and see whether it is a sincere problem they have or whether it's jealousy. There's jealousy here. There was rivalry and bad feeling. And they thought, or at least they covered up by a doctrinal difficulty. They said, about this baptism now. What about this baptism? They weren't worried about baptism. They were jealous for their leader. John had his leaders, and Jesus had his, and the disciples of John were coming and saying, that man Jesus is getting bigger crowds than you get, John. And they're trying to raise trouble there, and it was out of loyalty to the man John. The ability to excite loyalty is another dangerous thing. I complained to Dr. H.M. Schumann one time that I never get anybody to be loyal to me, and he said, thank God, he said, if you could make people loyal to you, you'd find wicked hands trouble in the day of Christ. But he said, if you can make them loyal to Christ, well, that's something else. And that's what I want, make people loyal to Christ, he said it to me. Paul had a hard time shucking people off, you know, shaking them off. He said, who's Paul? He wouldn't admit he was anybody, even though they tried to make somebody out of him. Now, out of many years' experience, I think I can say this with truth, that it's a very rare instance when two God-hungry Christians disagree. If they're not God-hungry, they can disagree over trifles, but if they're God-hungry, they'll not likely disagree. What passes for zeal very often is not zeal at all, but it is zeal for opinion rather than zeal for the Lord or for the Lord's work. It's zeal for their view of things rather than zeal for the Lord. Religious disputes over trifles rarely have an honest origin. Almost always they are the result of a deeply unspiritual state which they won't identify nor confess. So, they come and start a religious problem. It's not religious at all. So when they came to John and they said, Master John, this is one he's baptizing over here. Rabbi, they said, he that was with thee beyond Jordan. Well, now John did something that he rarely did. Maybe he thought the end was coming, and he was a little kinder than he had been. John wasn't a kind preacher. He lifted the question up to its proper level, and very gently for John, that is what I mean, he did something that was rarely done by John. He was gentle. John wasn't a gentleman, that is, he wasn't a gentleman. He saw through their pettiness, and instead of hiding it and covering it over and calling it positive thinking, he spiked it for what it was, but he did manage to do it in a gentle way. He said to them, in effect, your problem is not ritual. Your problem is not practice. It's not water. Your problem is your far-off relation to God. He said, no man can receive anything except it be given him from heaven. And if I receive something from heaven and Christ received something from heaven, what are you jealous about? If it isn't from heaven, why be jealous of something that will die with the using and perish with the flesh? But if it comes from heaven, then thank God and don't get jealous. But there's a lot of religious jealousy. I hear men attacked by other men, and they have good, valid arguments against the men, but I'm afraid that it's jealousy. Billy Graham gets kicked around by a lot of people that are just plain jealous of him. And almost every man who gets into prominence gets attacked by men who are just jealous. John has found that here, and he didn't fool with it. He said, you're jealous. That's your problem. He said, in effect, I told you that I'm not the Christ. This one that's coming is the Christ. And my joy is in standing in his shadow and rejoicing as he rejoices in the bride. And therefore, I haven't anything for you to defend. You don't have to defend me, he said to his disciples. I've done my work. I'm doing my work. And you must remember this, that from here on, I get smaller and smaller, and he gets larger and larger. Knox translation says, he must become more and more, and I must become less and less. Now, who said this? Some of us, when we try to become less, don't have to work very hard at it because there wasn't too much to start with, you know. The shorter your pencil, the less time it takes to whittle it down. And to whittle John down to size was something because John was the most popular preacher of his day. He was a colorful preacher. He just clearly showed and the crowd would come, you know. And that was the type of man he was. And he had a big reputation, now believe me, and he had other campaigns lined up, I suppose, or at least thinking of him in modern terms he would have had. And they were jealous for him. He said, this is what you don't know. He said, I've had my time in the sun, and now I'm bowing out and he's bowing in. And from here on, he must become more and more, and I must become less and less. I must come down from the height of being the greatest preacher in this generation to being less and less and less and finally getting my head cut off. Now, this was John's last public utterance. And it gives us the secret of his greatness. He must increase, but I decrease. And here condensed into this sentence is the secret of this great man, John. But you know, here's the wonderful contradiction, the wonderful divine paradox. He said, I must get less and less, and he meant it. And before the world, he did get less and less, until finally he was slain. But while he was getting less and less, he was getting bigger and bigger. If he had been jealous of Jesus and blocked Jesus, or tried to block him, and had listened to the blandishments of his loyal disciples, and had allowed them to talk him into a feeling of jealousy, he would have ended everything right there. He not only would have passed out of the picture, but he wouldn't even been written into the book. But because he tapered off and became less and less, to give Jesus a chance to become more and more, the ages, thank God, was on the back. He has not only been pastor to the little flock in Galilee, but he's pastor to all the centuries. You don't go a whole week in any church anywhere in the world, you don't have at least a reference to John the Baptist. John the Baptist is great because he became small. He might be used for hundreds of years because he said, I'm getting less and less in order that Jesus may become greater and greater. Now, he gave us this in a sentence, I say, not only the secret of his greatness, but the secret of every prophet and saint that ever has lived in the world, the secret of all the great souls has been, they learn the art of being nothing in order that Jesus Christ might be something. Now, for you to be nothing and get to be nothing and stay nothing and keep getting more nothing all the time, doesn't mean you have to have a low opinion of yourself. A lot of us Alliance people crawl around on their tummies like a paddled spaniel. And we feel that that's godliness. We have no culture and we say, well, that's spirituality. We have no education, we say, that's spirituality. We've never been nowhere and that's spirituality. And we ain't got nothing and that's... No, no, brother. The coolest old ragged bum down on Skid Row, because he qualifies for spirituality according to your definition. But the simple fact is, no matter how great before God a man knows himself to be, humility requires that he become nothing for the time being in order that Christ can become all. Remember that it said Jesus, knowing who he was, and that he had come down from heaven, and that he was going back to heaven, took a towel and girded himself and washed their feet. Now, he didn't wash their feet because he was just a poor fellow and didn't know any better. He knew who he was, where he'd come from, and when he was going back. And yet he humbled himself from that high, elevated position and became a servant to wash people's feet. So, you don't know, no matter if it's given how great you are, my brother, and you don't have to lie to yourself. If you know you have gifts and God bless you, you don't have to lie to yourself. You can take it. Let a man think soberly as he ought to think about himself. But at the same time, let him deliberately and purposely become less and less to give Jesus Christ a chance to become more and more and more. And if you do that, you prolong, you immortalize your service. You immortalize yourself. Isn't it a terrible thought, brother, isn't it a terrible thought that we can live and minister and have a flock and have missionary conventions and missionary offerings and dedicate babies and baptize and marry and bury and all the rest, and when it's all over, we have served ourselves instead of serving Christ. We want to do it in order to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, I don't for one second think that's true of this man, nor of anybody on this platform, but it's possible, you see. I hope it's not true of me. But the human heart is so subtle that sometimes I'm scared about it. That what you do, I'm afraid I'm doing it for an ulterior motive. John the Baptist didn't. He said, my joy is in seeing Jesus Christ grow before the people and myself taper out. Well, now, this is the secret of victory. These are the days when people want victory, and there are a lot of books being written about how to have spiritual victory, but they all want the shortcut. There is no shortcut to victory, and there is no easy way to victory. There is no easy way to die. It has never yet been discovered, brother. Never been discovered unless you die in your sleep. Nobody ever dies the easy way. Just as there is no place found on the human body where it's convenient to have a boil, so it is, and there's no way where it's convenient to die. You die of hanging or gas or the rope or an accident or a crash or cystitis or lumbago. You die, nevertheless. And there's nothing pleasant about dying. Well, now there's a voice here, and I want you to hear this wonderful voice. Jesus must increase, and as he increases, I decrease. But as I decrease, I get larger. And as I taper off, my ministry is prolonged and perpetuated. And said John, as I get smaller and smaller, God adds centuries and centuries to my influence and my power. The dear old saints that lived away back there, they had nothing. There were two men who lived and preached, great preachers. One of them was T.D. Whit-Talmage, the American orator. The other was Charles Spurgeon, the great English Baptist preacher. Charles Spurgeon preached the Bible, and T.D. Whit-Talmage roamed the skies and reached upward for effect. He was the orator. They both died, and Spurgeon's tabernacle still running. And T.D. Whit-Talmage just died with it. It's always that way. If you want to last and influence next generation and the next generation and the next generation, taper off, be nobody, get out of sight, get underneath, get under the rug, and God will bless you, and you will know it. That's the wonderful thing. Now, I want you to hear these words. He must increase and I must decrease. I must decrease in order that he may increase. Now those are strange sounds for modern years. Sometimes I feel I'm what they call wrongly now an anachronism. You know, an anachronism is something that outlives your generation. Really, anachronism means exactly the opposite, but we're using it like that now. Like somebody having a coal stove, you know, in an apartment here in Pittsburgh. Nobody has coal stoves anymore. And I hear God say things that I don't know whether anybody else is hearing them or not, but if they are, they're not reporting what they hear. I hear him say, you got to decrease, soldier, in order that Jesus Christ can increase. He must increase, and you got to get little if he's going to get big before the people. Now, in this religious vanity fair where we find ourselves, now I might as well tell you, that's my opinion of the Church of Christ today, the evangelical church, including the Alliance. It's just vanity fairs, all. Little godliness, little puddles of godliness lying here and there, but no rivers of godliness flowing, just little puddles, and most of them have wiggle worms in them, and a few toads around the edges, just puddles, you know. But God wants us to have rivers. The reason we don't have rivers is we're not hearing the right voice. It's just vanity fair religion. Men promote themselves without shame today. Without shame, they promote themselves. Years ago, somebody told me, why don't you get a red tie and get a publicity agent? You go over big. What an idiot that was. And it was even a missionary that said it. You know, God help that missionary for saying a thing like that. What would I do with a red tie and a publicity agent? I'd wear a red tie if I wanted to, and I'd wear it whether you like it or not. But then publicity agent, I don't want to be publicized. John didn't hire a publicity agent. He was so colorful that he had to pull a veil around himself in order to keep from shining. He just faded out, and Jesus, as he faded out, Jesus flared up. And that's the way it always should be. But men promote themselves shamefully, and language is used about people. You know where the comic page is in the average newspaper on Saturday? It's the church page. If you want to really laugh, go to the church page. There you will hear unknown boys whose ears stick out like taxicab doors standing open, and who aren't yet quite dry behind the ears, being billed in language that would have made Spurgeon blush, and that George Truett wouldn't have permitted them to use. Great, long, sesquipedalian adjectives describing little guys, you know, that haven't got a thing and will never have at that rate. And we describe these nobodies, these Johnny-come-latelys, in extravagant, exorbitant, exaggerated language, so preposterous as to amount to downright lying. And yet we do it, and we incorporate that into our Christianity. Now, if a fellow backslide and do that, we pray for him, he'd return to grace. But that's a part of the modern religious picture, and we don't know what's wrong. We don't know the fellow's backslide, so we don't pray for him. We follow him around. In this vanity fair, where publicity is worshipped like a god, to be known in the gate, to get your picture in the paper, to have somebody quote you, to imagine you're somebody, that's publicity, and it's worshiped like a god. And success is courted like a streetwalker, just to succeed, to put something over, and to get it written up. That's where we're living now, and where the secret dream of a lot of our Christian young people is not to be saintly, but to get into pictures. And the only reason they don't is because they can't. A lot of people go to the mission field or marry a preacher or teach the Sunday school class because they couldn't make it in Hollywood. A lot of singers can't make it in the record business and the recording business, and so they stay and sing around the church. Too bad, my brother, too bad. That if a fellow finds he's good, why, he goes to the world. Many of our popular recorded according artists are men who began singing in a church choir, the same with girls. As soon as they found they were good enough to put it over, they left the church like a rock leaving a ship was about to sink. Out they went. Now that's the Christianity that we're in today. That's why I'm not a happy man. Don't pray for Brother Tozer that he'll be happy. I don't want to be happy. I want to be holy. I don't want to be, useful. I can get along without being happy. I never was much a happy type of fellow, you know. Anyhow, and I can get along without being happy, but I want to be useful. And if being useful means to stick your chin into the wind, you know, and buck the gale. I'm glad to do it, because there are so many people that turn their back on the wind and go along with it. I don't believe in it. There's a voice I hear, and I hope you hear it. He must increase. Jesus must increase. And we must decrease. Now that voice sounds very strange in this day, I say. It sounds like a voice out of the past. It sounds like a voice out of the future. It sounds like a voice with no past and no future. A voice speaking out of eternity. If you want to be great, be little. If you want to be high, get low. If you want to go up, step down. If you want to be blessed, seek to bless others. If you want to live, die. If you want to be rich, give everything away. And if you want to be mighty, be weak. That's the voice of John, the voice of Paul, the voice of Jesus. Take your cross and follow me. But we don't like it in our day, and yet it's here. Now, there's a rare soul that can hear this. I preach for the rare souls. I don't preach for the crowds. I preach for the rare people that can hear. The astonishing thing is to me that anybody comes to hear me, except a half a dozen old saints. Because I positively preach for the rare soul that's in here. Is there anybody listening to me that's hearing another voice? That's hearing your voice saying, I've got stuff decreasing. I'm too big. I'm too big for my clothing. I'm swelling up. I gotta get down. That's deflating yourself. Deflate yourself to the point of total devaluation, where you're not worth one penny on a dollar. You're no good, and before God, and then the Lord will start making you useful to His kingdom and to the ages. Well, your spiritual life is going to depend upon what you do with this sound you hear, this voice. The intensity and quality of your spiritual life and the fruit of your Christian testimony and the result of your labors, they all depend upon what you do with this. He, Jesus, must increase, and I must decrease. If you're not willing to get little, why, all right, you take a second, a third, a fifth-rate place in the kingdom. But if you're willing to get little, the Lord will push you up. When you make a feast, said Jesus, and you invite your guests, He said, you guests, don't go in and go up to the top, because if you do, you get bumped down, and somebody that's a bigger VIP than you are comes in. But you take the low place, and then if you're a VIP, somebody will discover you. You know, a lot of you dear people are being little because you're trying to be big. Now, if you try to be little, that'll make you big after a while, you know. Not right away. You know it's better than to do it right away. He'd crush you up and you'd blow up like a small H bomb. But you'll do it a little at a time, and the beautiful thing about it is you won't know it. The Lord will make you big, and you won't know it. Some of the biggest people I know are as naive as the children about it. They haven't the remotest idea they amount to anything. Yet they're blessing the whole country. And they don't know it. Just as humble and meek about it, and they look at you out of starry eyes, wonder what you're talking about when you try to compliment them. Well, that conscious you, Jesus Christ, also will depend upon whether you're little or big. You stand in His way, you can't have much communion with Him. But if you'll get out of His way, He'll shine, and He'll shine through you. Now, if I were to ask this congregation, do you want to get something from the Lord? I'd have half the congregation at the altar. Everybody wants to get something. But if I were to ask the congregation, who wants to get rid of something, there'd be half a dozen. And some of them wouldn't be. Well, the fact is, we don't want to get rid of things. We want to get something else. Who wants to get blessed? Who wants to get filled? Who wants to get a gift? And they all come. Who doesn't like Santa Claus? Anybody likes to get a gift. But when we say, who wants to get smaller and smaller and smaller, you can't get crowds that way. And you can't get people to listen to you much. But I have a feeling some are hearing me now. And you won't say much about it today, but God will hound you with this and all the days ahead. And I'll be praying that He will. I want Him to. I don't want Him to make you fat and happy and sleepy. I want Him to make you lean and tough and spiritual. Well, now, how about this? Be thou exalted, O Lord. Be getting bigger and bigger, Lord, and I get smaller and smaller. Getting be exalted over everything, Lord, over me, Lord, over my friendship. A lot of people would rather have friends than to have the friends. They'd rather have a number of friends than to have the one friend. So their friendships get in their way. But you got to be willing that your reputation should get smaller and smaller. Most preachers fight to keep their reputation going up and up and up. But John said, my reputation's on the way out. He said, pretty soon I'll retire and go to Carlisle. And sit third from the end on the bench, you know. Nobody wants to think of that, but John said, I'm retiring. He's going to do it the hard way. But he said, I'm retiring. I'm getting smaller and smaller because there's somebody coming that's much greater than I am. And when you see him, you won't even listen to me. And I don't know anything that I'd rather do than to go to a church service sometime and have the leader get up and say, we can't listen to Tozer. We're hearing Jesus Christ. Let's pray. That would be the best thing that could happen. And you've got to get rid of your reputation. Some of us fight for our reputation. If anybody criticizes us, we send a hot letter back. You have to put it you have to wrap it up, you know, so it won't burn because we want to defend our reputation. If you defend your reputation, you'll have the job of doing it all by yourself. God won't help you. But if you sacrifice your reputation, the Lord will look after it for you. You'll see nobody ever rob you of your reputation. And then my ministry and my ambition. I got to die to that, brethren. Your ministry and your ambition to be great, to have a bigger church. Lord, bless me in my little church so I can get a bigger church. And when we're called to a bigger church, we pray over it while we pack our goods. You know, to see if it's the Lord's will while we're packing. My ministry, my ambition. Occasionally in the Alliance, we find some fellow who's godly enough to take a project. We call it a Key City Project. Give up his big church and go take a Key City Project. God bless me, you know, he's a wonder unto many. Because there aren't many like that, but there are a few. Then my property. Lord, be exalted over my property. I don't have to have property. Be exalted over my family, Lord. And you know, this American honeysuckle type of Christianity, particularly that southern type. You know, the Christianity is a little cabin with honeysuckles around the door and the yellow rose bush on the lawn and a dog lying asleep on the unpainted porch and grandma rocking while she knits with a smile on her face and her old Bible there on the table with her wire-rimmed glasses. That's American Christianity. We have the remotest concept of what it is. We equate it with Americanism. Christianity and Americanism are no more related than you can imagine. You can be an American and a Christian and an American, but the two aren't identical, you know. And besides that, you can be a Christian and never see a hound dog sleeping on the porch, and never smell a honeysuckle, and never see Grandpa knitting, or Grandma, I mean, knitting. You can do it. So let's get this idea that Christianity is that dreamy, oratorical, sentimental, droopy kind of Christianity that we hear men preach about. My brother, sometimes, if you're going to walk with God, you're going to have to buck your family. You're going to have to stand against them. I'm from the hills of Pennsylvania out here. And when I got converted, finally over in Ohio where we moved, and I got converted, I had to stand against my family. My mother was Tory, and my father was Tory, and everybody looked at me as if I had suddenly lost my mind or blown a fuse when I got converted. God saved me from hearing a man preach on the street corner. And I went home, went up to the attic, and got converted. Everybody worried about me. Then when I began to preach on the street myself, my mother said, why, unless my son preacher, not on the preaching, but preaching on the street, she was a Presbyterian. And she couldn't stand it, you know, that anybody preached on the street. I had turned my back on my family before I could get right with God. I had to do it. Work out on them. But you know what happened? Wasn't very long until my father got converted, then my mother got converted, then my two sisters got converted, then my brother-in-law got converted, and my boarder got converted. But I had to start out, you know, by turning my back on the whole crowd. Oh, Lord, make me smaller and smaller that you can get bigger and bigger. A lot of people's family stands in their way. I've known preachers who had wives, and they let those wives get in their way. Listen, Reverend, there's some wives, the only thing you can do is them to get up on their shoulders. You know, stand up there and help God and reach for heaven, because if you let him stand in your way, you'll taper off and get littler and littler in the wrong way, and the Lord won't get bigger and bigger. If you've got a good wife who understands you and prays for you and puts up with you, thank God every morning at 6 o'clock that you got such a wife. But if you don't have such a wife, don't, and for that reason, refuse to go on with God. Socrates, a young man asked Socrates, shall I get married or not? Yes, he said, get married. And he said, if you get a good wife, you've got a wonderful thing. And if you get a bad wife, you'll make a philosopher out of it. And John Wesley said, my wife is my sanctification. So your family can be the stepping stone by which you rise to higher things. If they're all Christians, thank God. But don't sit back and set your paw like a hibernating animal and worry the rest of your life. Go on with God. Men have always had to do it. And then my help. Some fellows take such care of themselves. Two men I know had heart trouble. One of them went out to California and retired. And he sat around, waited, and listened to his ticker. You know, took his own pulse and waited around. He lived about 8 years. But he wasn't alive. He just thought he was, you know. He's so afraid he would die that he'd already passed away. And another man, what was that great big tall handsome fellow who used to get Princeton Bible Institute he came to me and he said, you know, I got the same thing he had. He said, I got a coronary condition here too. And he said, I might just die any minute. But he said, am I going to sit around? I am not. He said, I want to die in Perna. And he did just exactly that thing. Exactly 1 year later, they found Kilgore lying beside his bed. His soul had gone to be with God. But in the meantime, he'd had one whole year preaching and teaching and praying. Oh, my friend, if you're so worried about your health, that old carcass that you're tramping around in, that old dinged up 1914 Ford that you've got, it'll go to pieces one of these days, and they'll throw it out on the old rust pile. But when the Lord comes, he'll give you a new body like unto his glorious body. Don't worry about your health, and don't worry about your life. Don't worry about your life. Lord, if you must let my life taper off, John soon lost his life. I'll give this illustration and quit. Pray to look at my watch. Many generations ago, when men used to go to the desert and seek what we call the deeper life, the spirit-filled life, and sought to get away from the vanity fair of their day, some of them became great saints, great souls, and they wrote great books that have blessed the centuries. Well, one day one of those old fellows was approached by a young man. The young man said, Father, you are known far and wide as being a man of God, a crucified man, a man who carries his cross. I want you to know, tell me, what does it mean when it says, I am crucified with Christ? The cross by which I am crucified unto the world. Said, what is it to be crucified? Well, as near as I can recall it, for I pull it out of my memory. The old man thought of it and he said, well, young fellow, here are five things about a crucified man. He said, when a man is hanging on a cross, he's only facing one direction. Yet he doesn't change his mind and go this way one day and the other way. Now, he said, he stays right there facing one direction. He said, now that's what it means to be crucified with Christ. When Christ hung on the cross, he faced one direction. Some of you face all directions at once, and that's your trouble, you know. Every new evangelist would come and go to the altar because he'd been facing the wrong way. And you get faced around, and when time his plane is over Indiana, why, you're facing around again. He said, the crucified man only faces one direction. He said the second thing about a crucified man who's hanging on a cross, he's making no plans for tomorrow. He hadn't got any plans for tomorrow. He's not going to be around tomorrow, you know. And so he's making no plans.
You isn't worrying his head about the plans. He's just hanging up there suffering. Somebody else is making his plans, and that's point number three. He said he has no will of his own. Somebody else is making his plans for him. The Roman government, for instance, made his plans. He doesn't do a thing but just hang up there according to the will of the Roman government. Now, he said the man who's crucified, he isn't planning and running his life. Somebody else is running his life, even Jesus Christ the Lord. Then he said another thing about that man hanging up there. He's not going back. He said goodbye to his family. He's not coming back. He said he's out there and there's all his bridges are burnt behind him and he's not coming back. And he said the fifth thing is he's lost all interest in the world. He said he's lost all interest in the world. He doesn't say, would you please read the stock market report to me, John? While he hangs there, he knows what the stock market mean to him. He had all kinds of stock, and it was going up like a rocket. He still wouldn't gain from it, because he's going to be dead shortly. And he doesn't say, who won the hockey game last night? Or is so-and-so coming in person to Pittsburgh? He's not worried about who's coming in person or coming in the spiritual form. Because he's lost interest in the world. That's the crucified man. Now, the Christian Missionary Alliance grew out of this thing, that we might have it again. That the children of the Lord who gather around our churches might know that the crucified man has lost all interest in the world. He isn't going back and is making no provision for the flesh. He has no will of his own but the will of God. He's making no plans for the future. His plans are in the hands of God. And the only faith is one direction. Oh, what a change it would make in our lives. You know, it hurts a little bit. Crucifying isn't an easy thing to know. There is no antibiotic pill that you can take to crucify. You have to go right out there and let them wham the nails into your palms. And they hurt. They hurt, I tell you. You suffer. Some of you won't suffer, you can't range. You won't die and you can't live. You won't go down, you can't get up. You want to hire people to come in and entertain you and preach to you and make you feel good, and I don't want to be one of them. It won't work, sister. There's only one way to get up, and that's start down. So if you've heard the voice today, get smaller and smaller and smaller. The Lord will begin to put Jesus Christ bigger and bigger and bigger. And the wonder of it all is that unknown to you, through you, God will be blessing you and making you greater and greater while you're getting smaller and smaller. Wonderful paradox. May God grant that it take place in your life. Amen.
There are many men over and across America who are speaking about the spiritual life and the matter and the need of being sanctified, but there is none whom I would rather hear and whom I would rather present to you as a speaker along this line than our friend Dr. A.W. Tozer, who is now minister at the Avenue Road Christian and Missionary Alliance Church in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and the editor of the Alliance Witness. It has been a real joy to have had him with us for these weekday afternoons. God bless you, Dr. Tozer.
It's been a pleasure to be here. You have to do some things by faith, and preaching here is being done by faith. I don't know what contribution I've made, but I'm trusting that it has been a little bit. With my car for maybe. Now, I want to talk today, as I promised or threatened yesterday, on the text, he must increase, but I must decrease. Verse 25 of John 3, there arose a question between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purifying. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he that was with thee beyond Jordan, to whom thou bearest witness, behold, the same baptizes, and all men come to him. John answered and said, now I like the way John changed the subject here. John answered and said, a man can receive nothing except it be given him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said I am not the Christ. I am sent before him. He that has the bride, the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, which is named John, which standeth and heareth him, he rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Takes a pretty unselfish bridegroom, or best man, I mean, to stand and rejoice in the good fortune of the bridegroom and not be jealous. This my joy, therefore, is fulfilled. I think this is one of the most selfless testimonies ever given here. And he added, for the last 7 words in English, we have it at least, ever uttered by this man in public. He must increase, but I must decrease. Now these men, Jesus and John, were baptized. In their journey, they had come near to each other. Although, of course, Jesus himself didn't actually put people down into the water, but his disciples, as it says across the stage in John 4. John was bringing his colorful ministry to a close. We know, no matter how spiritual we get, we're still pretty much committed to our humanity. Yet down here, up there, it's going to be different. And when I say that John was a colorful man, I'm using a dirty word, a word that's gotten into baseball, into the theater, into politics, got all kicked around. But you can't get away from it, there isn't any other word. John was a colorful character. Some people have color and some don't. He used to say about 2 baseball players, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, they said Babe Ruth could strike out and get more applause than a little Lucy Jerry got when he hit a home run. There are colorful men. And then there are men who just preach. I'm the latter type. I don't have any color. I don't even have any in my hair anymore. The man who has color has an awful time getting it separated from the Holy Ghost, so that he knows when it's God and when it's color. But a man who is comfortably without color, he knows it's either God or else he won't get invited back.